as a response to the lack of cooperation from Governor Kathy Hochul and New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani on the federal government's crackdown on immigrants, which the New York Times reports it is named Operation Rotten Apple. Those are the latest Pacifica headlines. For the Pacifica Network, I'm Jesse Lent.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features We Have the Right to Organize. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Mwiza Muntali. The music in the background is Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley and the Wailers. To commemorate this year's Labor Day in the U.S., Africa Now goes to its archive with a show featuring a discussion with Destiny Blackwell, a member of CAUSE, Carolina Amazonians United for Solidarity and Empowerment, and Chris Hollis, member of Black Workers for Justice and UE 150, and members of CUME University, an educational partner of Black Workers for Justice. And those members are James Pope and Robin D.G. Kelly, Distinguished Professor and Gary B. Nash Endowed Chair in U.S. History at UCLA. And of course, James Pope is executive producer and co-host of Africa Now and member of Africa World Now Project Collective. The discussion is from a 9-part series that explored and discussed the role and demands of workers. The series presented by the CUME University in collaboration with Black Workers for Justice and the Southern Workers Assembly focused on the 9 points of the Southern Workers Power Program. The session which the show focuses on is the first point of the Southern Workers Power Program, which is We have the right to organize and form unions, collectively bargain and strike. Therefore, we demand A, that all workplace decisions are made with worker input and control, including the right to a decent job with a living wage based on local cost of living with frequent and regular raises. B, safe and healthy workplace, paid sick leave, paid family and parenting leave, just cause for termination, retirement, security, and a reduced work week without reduced pay. And C, reduce barriers to union organizing by prohibiting mandatory captive audience meetings and increasing penalties for illegal anti-union activity. Here is James Pope, Africa Now's executive producer and co-host, moderating the session.
Greetings, everyone. I'd like to thank you for joining us this evening. A special shout out to everyone who decided to spend their evening on this Labor Day with us. And who is us? The CUME University, which is part of BWFJ, Black Workers for Justice, the research, study, education arm of BWFJ. And we are doing these webinar sessions specifically in collaboration with Southern Workers Assembly and Black Workers for Justice. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for taking your time out today. We have a panel, some speakers that we really intend to engage with some critical thinking and some critical engagement and discourse around the Southern Workers Program in focus. Before we begin, I just wanted to give a special nod to Esther Cooper Jackson, who recently passed into ancestorhood. And I'd like to just take a quick opportunity to just talk about, you know, the freedom fighter, communist, writer, theorist, publisher of Freedom Ways, someone who had a very, very important impact on many, many, many people in the context of organizing in the South, organizing workers, organizing for human rights. As one of the founding members of the first SNCC, the Southern Negro Youth Congress, but also many, many other organizations, friends with Paul and Icelander Robeson, and also just really, really important in the context of radical Black workers, radical movements, but human rights in total, friend of W.E.B. Du Bois as well. I just wanted to take an opportunity to just give homage, to pay respect to Esther Cooper Jackson. As we begin tonight, and the reason why we're here, the intention of these series, this collaboration with BWFJ and SWA, which also is the inaugural program of the Communiversity, which is also related directly to the videos that you actually just saw. It is the UE 150 25th anniversary, and also the Southern Workers Alliance 10th anniversary. And those were the videos that we kind of showed to kind of put together a little collage of what's happening in the context of the genealogy, the history of organizing, specifically workers in the South. But the intention of this particular series and this collaboration is to explore and closely examine the Southern Workers Assembly Workers Power Program as a platform from which collective worker power can be consolidated and extended. Centering the Southern worker, it is the intention of these sessions to lead to build a comprehensive and radical workers program against the explicit efforts of the current fascist regime within and without the United States socio-political structures of authority. Building the collective consciousness of the base will aid in effectively organizing and building a movement of workers to wage struggle against the accelerative destructive forces of capitalism. And with that being said, we have developed, and the WE is the study working group, which is part of the Communiversity, again, the inaugural program that you are all gathered here together with us, is to really explore the non-points. And tonight, we want to study and engage and think through the first particular point, which we have a panel of worker organizers, theorists, writers, thinkers, and doers to help us engage, and also you, because as we are starting to really engage in the discourse, we ask you to put your questions in the Q&A section or in the chat function. We're looking for comments. We're looking for questions as well. But tonight we have gathered specifically to engage in the first point of the Southern Workers program. We have a right to organize and form unions, collectively bargain and strike. Therefore, we demand that all workplace decisions are made with worker input and control, including the right to a decent job with a living wage based on local cost of living with frequent and regular raises. B, safe and healthy workplace, paid sick leave, paid family and parenting leave, just cause for termination, retirement security, and a reduced work week without reduced pay. Also, C, reduce barriers to union organizing by prohibiting mandatory captive audience meetings and increasing penalties for illegal anti-union activity. And to join us today to really think through, to study, and to really, really critically engage in a conversation around this particular point, which is part of the total workers program, we have Destiny Blackwell of Calls. We have Chris Hollis of UE 150. And then, of course, we have who will be responded, Robin D.G. Kelly and myself, James Pope, who will try to organize all of this fantastic ideas, all the fantastic ideas that are going to come from this particular panel, but also those who are participating. With that being said, I'm going to end my opening remarks and turn it over to Chris Hollis to begin the discussion.
I first want to start out with saluting everyone in this webinar, because you could have been doing something else, but you're here today, gathered together, because we all have purpose and we all want change. I'm Brother Chris Hollis. I'm a worker, been a blue collar worker for over 20 something years of my life. Understanding the struggle, especially in the South. There's many battles and fronts that I've been engaged in, along with the working, you know, the working class. I know that we all have challenges, and these challenges come from the boss. These challenges, they also come from this capitalist government that we're under. And at your job, you might be going through some struggles, you know, and you might like be curious of what can you do about it. You know, I say the first thing is to build relationships and have the conversations with your coworkers. Because if you're feeling it, of course, they're feeling it as well. We spend more time with our coworkers than we do our own family. When you look at the hours on the job, when you look at annually, you're spending more time with these workers. Therefore, it's family. It may be an extended family, but it's still your family. And these issues that you're going through, of course, they're going through it as well. I'm gonna give you a quick example. I worked at a poultry rendering plant. This plant takes care of all of the rendering in the state of North Carolina. North Carolina is the number one poultry producing state in the country. They have over 56 chicken plants and 55 chicken farms. Without this rendering company, there would be no produce, poultry, in any of the grocery stores because the plants cannot operate. The FDA would come in and shut them down. So the conditions at this plant was intolerable. Workers were actually dying. You can come to work and say hi to your coworker before the end of the shift, something tragically has happened to them. Workers were tired. You know, they feared for their lives. So we started to organize. We started to organize about working conditions, the hazardous working conditions. You know, we looked at the policy, the handbook. We had these conversations. The company would violate certain policies, but how would you know unless you read your handbook? So education became essential as we organized. And as we organized, we've seen a lot of the issues coming to light. We've seen the fear from the employer trying to intimidate workers, trying to violate workers' rights. And so what do? We exercise those rights. You know, as we organized, we reached out when we were strong enough to the local UE 150, which is one of the most militant unions in the South. We came in, we met and conferred with the boss. We marched on the boss. They met some of our demands. But the most critical demands during the COVID pandemic was keeping workers safe. Workers were getting sick, but there wasn't any sick leave. There wasn't any kind of compensation for the workers. So as we continue to organize and grow, we started a petition of demands. With this petition, we talked about the wage stuff. We talked about the hazardous working conditions. And when we went to hand it off to the boss, they refused to take it for fear that these workers are organized. When did this happen? I mean, they're coming at us boldly, demanding change. And that's what happens when workers come together. So essentially, building these organizing committees is the foundation of trying to start and go forward with your union. Because without these committees, which are cadres, you really can't circle the wagons around the issues without getting other workers involved. So full worker engagement is essential. We have to engage with each other in order to understand what everybody is going through. So we had a list of demands. There was about 8 or 9 demands. One was COVID protection, safe conditions on the job, pay us what we work for. All hours work, hours paid. In the end of the day, they started trying to target workers, but we stood together. We held weekly meetings, and I encourage you all to get with one another in your workplace. If it's outside of your workplace or on your break or your lunchtime, socialize with one another. Strengthen your cadre, strengthen your committee, because without their strength and without you all coming together in solidarity, it's going to be a struggle trying to unionize at your workplace. In 2020, in Virginia, I have the opportunity to this day to continue to work with some strong workers, municipal workers, who started out addressing their conditions with a strike. It came out of the blue. Prior to collective bargaining becoming law in Virginia, to the state and to the ordinance, it was illegal. Collective bargaining was illegal. Going on strike was illegal. But waste management formulated a walkout. They stood by their vehicles and they were strategic. They waited for a Wednesday, which was when all of the upper class people in the city needed their trash taken up. They stood down. The city manager received phone call after phone call after phone call. Workers refused to go out. It made the news media immediately. And in less than a week, their conditions changed at waste management. The equipment that was faulty, they received new leased equipment. They received a 10% raise. You know, they met and conferred with their superintendent. What can we do to get y'all back to work? Right then, those workers knew that they had power, workers' power, collective power, to cause change to happen. Because when the city stops functioning, when the wheels stop turning, that's when people get concerned. That's when the citizens are like, why come my trash isn't picked up? That created a tidal wave that went into the other departments. And to this day, the UE 111 was formed in Virginia Beach. Those workers came together. Those workers seen the power of change. Those workers continue to educate themselves on the First Amendment rights of the Constitution, on their rights as a worker. And as we continue to educate, we continue to be empowered. More workers are continuing to stand up and fight for this change. Every city council meeting they attended with big signs held up in front of them. Support collective bargaining. Support workers. Give us livable wages. And just recently, this past July, they received the biggest raise increase for city workers, bringing the minimum wage up to $15 an hour. Giving workers time and grade, they developed a step plan where workers can see where they start and 10, 15 years down the road, what they can max out at. This is what workers fought for. Nobody is going to give you anything. You have to fight for it. You have to demand it. So continue to be the change that you're looking for, because that's the only way things are going to change. I'm going to yield the floor back to my comrades on this panel and be looking forward to more commentary. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. We will now center Destiny.
Hello, everybody. If you can hear me, my name is Destiny Blackwell. I'm a worker at Amazon, and I'm a member of CAUSE, which is Carolina Amazonians United for Solidarity and Empowerment. And we're grassroots organizing a union in Garner, North Carolina, right now as we speak. And we've seen the labor movement really, there's a swell in the labor movement right now. And part of it is driven by, we see people popping off unions at Starbucks and at Amazon and at these tech companies. And it is a groundswell that we're a part of. And people are learning that it is our right to organize our workplaces. When you go into your workplace, they want you to be powerless. They want you to have no say in anything. They want you to clock in, do your work, and leave. They don't want you to have any say. They want it to be like a plantation system where all the information, all of the direction comes top down. But with the power in a union, it's so that the workers who create all this wealth, that create the money that allows them to buy the machines, that allows Jeff Bezos to send himself to space in a rocket for a joyride, the workers that create this wealth get to have a say in where that wealth goes and gets to demand what we need for ourselves. And so When we are talking about the right to organize, it's not just a right, but it is a necessity. And even the rights that we have and what we're used to as a part of livable working conditions are things that we know were earned by labor movements of the past. We know that the weekend, the reason why we have a 40-hour work week, is something that people fought and struggled for. We know that overtime pay is stuff that people fought and struggled for. We know that healthcare benefits being associated with your job are things that people had to fight, work for, and die to receive. And so when we are answering the questions of our generation, when we are living in new conditions in a pandemic that none of us have ever seen before, we have to ask, what do we need now? When the labor rights that we live with today were acquired, it was in the 30s, it was an entirely different workforce than what we have now. And many of the people who I see as a member of my coworkers right now were deliberately excluded from the protections needed. They don't have the protections that women need for work. Protections against sexual assault, protections for the healthcare necessary for women's bodies. And for us to acquire the rights that we need, they're not going to give it to us just because it's the right thing to do. Everybody who has power has always had the ability to do the right thing. The only reason the right thing happens is because people ask for it. Frederick Douglass said that power concedes nothing without demands. And the way that we are able to raise our demands with strength, with power, is through collective action and through the voice of a union. And that's what me and my coworkers at Cause are working for. And so when we look across the floor at Amazon and we see poor Black people, we see poor women, we see poor white people, we see poor immigrants, okay? We see poor people with our poor people problems of injury, of mental health issues, of poverty. And we ask ourselves, why are all these poor people working for the richest company in the world? And we know that the company is the richest because they are taking the wealth from us. We know that somebody who makes trillions of dollars is trying to prevent people who make $15 an hour from getting enough money to pay for housing. We know that we know our coworkers are sleeping in their cars. We know our coworkers are missing rent payments and getting evicted and having to move in with parents and grandparents. We know that down here, but the result is because the people with power are never going to use it to the benefit of the powerless, because that's how they maintain their power, by hoarding it at the top. We know that that Amazon gets billions of dollars in tax cuts for employing disabled people, for employing people who are supposed to be from disadvantaged backgrounds, like HBCU students. But Amazon's not going to make the demand of itself to ask the question, why isn't Amazon just paying students enough to pay for their tuition? Why does Amazon get tax cuts to pay for university tuition instead of paying its workers enough to live, paying its workers enough for the conditions of their lives? And no one is going to make Amazon do it. No one is going to make Amazon, instead of giving hundreds of thousands of dollars for food banks, they're not going to say this money is supposed to be going to the workers so that the workers don't have to go to food banks. But that is the condition that we work under. And one thing that I think is most important is that it's not just our right, it is our duty to make the changes that we need to live in the modern society, not lose the 40-hour work week with Fortune 500 companies that want us to have gigs and have two or three jobs like the people at Amazon do, because they won't pay a living wage. If we don't want that to be our future, we have to take a stand right now, because you can't be neutral on a moving train. And this is what we're doing at Cause, and this is what's happening in the labor movement. as we organize together. And I'll give my time up here.
Thank you, Destiny. We definitely want to, make sure that those who are engaged with us this evening, to remind you, if you have any questions or comments, to please put them into questions into the question answer section, or any comments, you could put them in the chat. And now I would like to turn it over to Robin DG Kelly for comments and respond.
Okay, thank you, James. Thank you, Destiny. Thank you, Chris. Let me just begin by, having us think about the phrase, the right to organize, and just pause over that, because it is kind of absurd that, you have to fight for the right to organize and collectively bargain in a constitutional democracy purported to be a free country, right? So there are no laws against the right of capital to organize. So we get the Chamber of Commerce, we get the National Association of Manufacturers, we get the Business Roundtable, we get the American Legislative Exchange Committee, and many, many more. And these are the institutions, organized class power, that uses this power and resources to pass the very laws that Destiny was just talking about, laws that promote policies conducive to business at the expense of workers. I mean, laws that keep wages down so that the same companies could use the state and federal welfare system to subsidize their own exploitation of workers when workers don't make enough money to be able to have a living wage and have to turn to subsidies from the state or support. The most striking example of these laws, of course, is the right to work laws. And again, think of the absurd language here, right to work laws. When I tell my students that, and they're like, oh yeah, that's a good thing. Well, of course it's not a good thing, because the term right is used to mask the denial of rights. That is, the right to organize, what we're fighting for, what is point one of this workers' program, enables building political power and workers' power for challenging the rule of a class that does nothing but take our labor and wealth. The right to work, though, the way the language is used, is about suppressing democracy. So how do we get there? First, we have to acknowledge that the attack on workers' right to organize is evidence not of the weakness of workers' power, but of workers' actual power, so suppression of that power. It's a fear of that power. And this is something that Chris made very, very clear. The rest of the nation has come to believe that the South is conservative when it's the opposite that's true. The South has been the epicenter of the country's most radical democratic movements, led by interracial, often, if not always, Black-led labor insurgencies, which we got that from the films, from populism to coal and iron ore workers in Alabama, waterfront workers in New Orleans and Mobile, Pensacola, Charleston, textile, tobacco, lumber, poultry workers, North Carolina. So we have to be clear. All the stuff that came to define the Jim Crow South, segregation, lynching, disfranchisement, were ruling classes' responses to interracial labor movements. They were responses to workers' power. They were responses to an attempt to preserve and expand democracy, to protect the rights of working people, to redistribute land, dismantle plantation oligarchy. And the owners of capital could only win by doing several things. That's how we get Jim Crow. They win by employing state violence. They win by denying Black people the right to vote. They win by turning the South into a one-party fascist dictatorship. And they pass anti-labor legislation. They pass, racist legislation. They pass anti-immigrant laws, not because the South is conservative, but because ruling classes denied one third of the electorate the right to vote and then imposed his will. Incredibly, thanks to the militant organizing of Black workers in the 1930s, and this is something Destiny actually brought up briefly, we get the New Deal legislation that created the National Labor Relations Board that legalized unions, and labor began to build power against the efforts of the ruling classes, of the capitalist class. One of the great examples of this was the largely African-American female Local 22 of the Food, Tobacco, and Agriculture and Allied Workers Union, FTA, based in Winston-Salem. And Local 22 organized at R.J. Reynolds, very massive tobacco company, as we all know. They fought for higher wages, better working conditions. They promoted a radical vision of civil and human rights that was inseparable from labor rights. They protested segregation. They fought sexual harassment at work, a point that Destiny pointed out is not always covered by labor laws. But in this particular instance, they fought for it before there were laws in the books. They launched voter registration campaigns. They set up worker education classes, much like this. They established a library stocked with volumes of on African-American history. And they elected the first Black alderman, Reverend Kenneth Williams, in 1947. And so what happens? Workers achieve some power. They're gaining power. And after the Second World War, Congress then wages, the ruling class uses Congress, uses the state to pass legislation like the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947, which restricted workers' power, restricted the right of workers to strike, required things like a loyalty oath on the part of union officers who had to sign these affidavits affirming that they were not members of the Communist Party or any other subversive organizations. They prevented unions from contributing to political campaigns. In other words, they used the state, they used the power of government to undermine the power that workers were able to achieve in its class war.
You listen to a portion of a conversation from African Isles Archives, and we're playing this as we commemorate this year's Labor Day here in the U.S. And the conversation is with a member of CAUSE, that is the Carolina Amazonians United for Solidarity and Empowerment. And that member is Destiny Blackwell. Also featured is Chris Hollis, who is a member of the Black Workers for Justice and UE150. The conversation also features members of Communiversity, an education partner of Black Workers for Justice. And those members are James Pope, who is African Isles executive producer and co-host, and also a member of Africa World Now Project Collective. And the other member of Communiversity featured in this conversation is Robin D.G. Kelly, distinguished professor, and Gary B. Nash Endowed Chair in U.S. History at UCLA. The discussion is from a 9-part series that explores and discusses the role and demands of workers. The music in the background is The Freedom Suite by Sonny Rollins, and we play that remembering his birthday, which is September 7th. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
And in short, FTA is just one example. All kinds of unions suffered under the Taft-Hartley and the anti-communism of that period, like UE, for example. They refused to comply with Taft-Hartley's provision that unions could not have Communist Party members. And so a lot of these unions were expelled from the CIO in 1949. The ruling class used anti-communism to destroy the most progressive unions. They used anti-communism to destroy an organization called the National Negro Labor Council, which is sort of the equivalent of Black Workers for Justice of that time in the 50s. since they couldn't, you know, they didn't stop at just passing Taft-Hartley, they founded organizations, again, the right to organize on the part of capital. They founded the National Right to Work Committee, National Right to Work Committee, again, the absurd language, in 1955, whose leaders included people like the Koch brothers. State governments began outlawing collective bargaining. So again, it's not as if it was always like this. Workers win power, they achieve some gains, and then capital fights back and gives us the impression that the South is a conservative backwater. But in fact, this is class war we're witnessing. They outlaw collective bargaining for trade unions. They pass legislation constricting women's reproductive rights, criminalizing immigrants, and we know the rest. Also, they strengthened business and weakened unions by putting health and retirement benefits in the hands of employers and not the state. But just to end here, the lesson I think that we've heard from all the speakers is that, you know, this is not, point one of the workers' program is not about recognizing or acknowledging workers' power, workers' weakness, rather. It's about recognizing workers' power. It's about saying that the right to organize is the way to consolidate that power, its potential strength, especially when labor, you know, can organize, it can win. And like Destiny says, it's our duty to win. Because workers' power extends beyond the workplace, it means that workers' power is a threat to more than just the employer. It's a threat to all aspects of the ruling class's power over government, over society as a whole. So we know it makes a difference because this is why capital invests so much energy, so many resources, forcing people in these captive meetings to listen to anti-union propaganda. And this is exactly what Chris Hollis was talking about. They spend a lot of time and money waging class war. Workers' rights are civil rights. Workers' rights are immigrant rights. Workers' rights are trans rights, queer rights. Workers' rights are disability rights. And to secure those rights means building labor power, building worker power. Worker power, simply put, you know, in my definition, is it's creating a sustainable, enriching livelihood, safety and security for all people. And not just all people in the South, not just all people in the United States, but all people around the world. And to do this requires the not just the right to organize, but effective organization that could really take power and hold it. And I will just give it back to James.
No, thank you for kind of, you know, bringing all of that together. And again, if you have any questions, by all means, I can, you know, I don't mind. Brother Abdul have sent some questions. Other folk have sent questions that I would definitely like us to really engage in a discussion, really engage in a real, like I said, study, but also understand how we critically understand the importance of the points that are being made and to developing action. You know, Robin talked about this notion of workers' power. And so one of the questions that I think that is important that we can kind of throw out and kind of chew on it in the context of point one, and also the practice that Destiny and Chris, that you're engaged in organizing in the workplace. Respond to this question. Of course, Robin, you could come in as well. What efforts have been made, and we're talking about workers' power, what efforts have been made to build unity in the context of your workplace? You know, Chris, you briefly mentioned, you know, relationships. Destiny, you talked about relationships with intentional education, you know, those particular things. And Destiny, you can respond to this question first, but then by all means, then we can have Chris, and then Robin. And again, we want to make sure that everybody's engaged and everybody's having a conversation as well, including folk who are with us on the other side of this little chat box here. So Destiny.
Okay. So unity on the shop floor, So there's a lot of different ways that we've gone about doing this. One, you know, flyering, talking to people. We have regular meetings. Our co-founders of Cause, they're Mary Hill and Reverend Ryan. And honestly, they stand up and they talk back to the managers and they like stand up and defend their coworkers. And this is like being visible and vocal and standing up for each other has really been like the ground level building blocks of what Cause is doing. And even like on social media, right? We'll put bad managers on blast. We'll say this person is a bigot. This person sexually harasses the women who are working around here. And like, you know, people complain about it all the time. Everybody, it's common knowledge among the workers who experience it. But when Amazon, because Amazon watches us like a hawk, when Amazon sees it on blast, they respond. And then the managers are, they disappear or they're relocated and they come back acting brand new because it's like being able to raise your voice collectively is impactful. And
yes, I concur with, you know, what Destiny was just talking about. It's essential. When it comes to building unity, again, I'll reiterate building those relationships. You know, how can you unify with someone you don't trust them or you don't know them? You know, people will look at you like you're crazy. I hear so often from workers when we're having these conversations of organizing their departments, you know, bringing up the issues. And one of the main things a worker would say is, well, we're not going to stand together, right? I mean, a lot of us hear that. And my comeback is always, well, why don't you be the example? You know, be the example. Because identifying leadership is also essential. You know, that's one thing that we try to focus on in these workplaces is identifying leadership. Because depending on how many departments, or even if it's just one department, you have some leaders. I call them the unsung heroes, right? Those that are outspoken, you know, really putting your spidey senses on and just reading people, understanding people, watching behaviors, see who's the loudest and the most outspoken, right? Usually those are the ones you can go to and have conversations. And I always use a phrase, you have to slap them to shut them up because they won't stop talking. You know, the issues are just too broad and too great, but that's a good thing. Because you're getting them to talk about issues that affect everyone. And then you can start identifying other workers and have a petition of demands, I think is essential as well, because it's also a conversation starter. As you go around with this petition, you're getting names, you're getting numbers, contact information to be able to have these isolated one-on-one conversations. Not everyone is comfortable in a group. Some people you have to pull to the side and have that conversation. Some people are introverts, some are extroverts, but identifying those individuals and then really seeing what gets them moving and then tying it in together. Because unity at the end of the day is the only way we're going to get this done. We're in a protracted struggle. We say that there's not an end. But until workers get that workers' power collectively, start making demands, start demanding of the bosses. Like in Virginia, I'm so proud of those workers. They went to every city council meeting. They did speak outs, you know, to all the council members. I remember vaguely the city manager, as these workers were speaking, he was looking at his cell phone and he never looked up at the workers. And you all know him in the municipalities, the city manager has the purse, right? He has all the money. One of the workers that was speaking out looked at the city manager and told him in front of everyone, I hope you're looking at that budget on how you're going to give us our wages since you're looking so much at your phone. And I mean, you know, everybody was like, whoa. And it really empowered other workers to get up there and talk more junk to him. And then next thing you know, he's meeting privately with the workers. The mayor is meeting privately with the workers. And shortly after that, they passed a bill that workers would receive a minimum of $15. And it's not over with. because gas is going up, groceries are going up, but our wages are trickling up. And we know that they have all the money, but without the workers, how can they make money? You know, it's labor over health, right? It's like health care should be a human right. You know, we should not have to struggle. Some workers are working tirelessly and then opting out on their insurance because they can't pay a bill. So the struggle is real. And these workers are gathering around real live issues, because this is what you take back to the dinner table. You know, when the wife is out there going through the cabinets and looking what she got, and you're balancing your checkbook to the wages that you're getting, you know, the struggle is real. But we have to continue to fight, continue to unify in order to get to that next level. And that's always demanding for the workers. I'll yield the floor.
So I have a question from one of my colleagues and comrades, for Chris and Destiny, as you're thinking about this. But I also want Robin to really talk about, you know, this particular moment in the context of organizing. This is generally a different moment, right? I mean, the dominant labor unions, or these are independent worker movements that are happening and consolidating in this particular moment. And so while you respond to that, Chris and Destiny, I want you to respond or think about, after Robin responds to that question, think about the question from my comrade, Shaf. How do y'all deal with fear in the workplace, right? Okay, go ahead, Robin.
No, very briefly, because I think so much has already been said. This is a moment of great optimism, I think, for a lot of people, because there are areas of organizing that have failed in the past and seem like they're beginning to succeed. My only concern about the way we see it is that, you know, we live in such a media-generated, media-oriented society that we will think that, you know, what's happening at Starbucks is like the beginning and end, when there's so many workers and so many struggles that have been going on and on and on for a long time. I think this webinar is extremely important because the kind of advice that Chris and Destiny are giving are advice that goes beyond the strategy of organizing that centers around just social media or email or, you know, using means that are not direct. And what you're talking about is like talking to actual people, building relationships outside of the workplace and establishing, you know, actual human relationships. And that historically has always been the thing that led to successful unions, not simply having a kind of flat strategy that's about reaching just all the people in a very flat way. You know, so I think that on the one hand, this is a unique moment and a moment to be optimistic. But in our history as Black people, this is the same moment we've been in. I'm saying that this, you know, it's not that different, you know, and we've always been both at the forefront of labor organizing, also at the forefront of being attacked, you know. So I think there's a lot of work.
Thank you. Destiny, you wanted to, how do you deal with fear in the context of organizing?
So I think that, like, kind of education is the, like, a lot of fear is coming from ignorance. A lot of people are afraid to be a part of organizing because they think that it's illegal. People straight up think it's illegal, because people, like, the number of times I've heard people say that right to work means that unions are illegal. It's just like the misconception that people have. And so, like, when you talk to people and you say, like, oh, like, no, it's not illegal. And that, oh, look, there are this many union shops around here. And if you, you know, UPS gets dollar raises, you have to work 18 months at Amazon to get a 25-cent raise. Like that's like, just like, not only is it like not illegal, but other people have it and they're not suffering, they're doing better than us. That's the sort of conversations you have. Also, like what Chris was saying about building relationships. And so it's like, you know, when people know that, hey, you're an organizer and you're still here, like, then people have some confidence that you kind of become an anchor, because people are aware that it's not like you say you're pro-union and you go straight out the door, because like they see people learn from, like, you know, the Panthers used to say that people learn from observation and participation. And so it's like, when they see that you're doing it, it's easier to do it too.
And Chris?
Yes. how do we deal with fear? Wow. I have many, many examples of personal experiences. I'll give one, if not two. There was a situation where we were organizing at this poultry plant. And we did a meet and confer. We know that education is essential. Because if you know your rights, what do you have to fear? To me, I look at fear as an acronym, false evidence appearing real. Right? Because the boss thinks he can get rid of you if you don't know your rights.
You just listened to a portion of a conversation from our archives as we commemorate this year's Labor Day in the U.S. The conversation was with Destiny Blackwell, who is a member of CAUSE, that is the Carolina Amazonians United for Solidarity and Empowerment. Also featured in the conversation was Chris Hollis. He's a member of Black Workers for Justice and UE150. Also featured in the conversation were members of Communiversity, which is an educational partner of Black Workers for Justice. And those members were James Pope, who is African Isles executive producer and co-host, and he's also part of the Africa World Now Project Collective, and Robin D.G. Kelly, Distinguished Professor and Gary B. Nash Endowed Chair in U.S. History at UCLA. The discussion was from a 9-part series that explores and discusses the role and demands of workers. The series was presented by the Communiversity in collaboration with Black Workers for Justice and the Southern Workers Assembly, focusing on the 9 points of Southern Workers Power Program. And today the show focused on the first point of the Southern Workers Power Program, which is we have the right to organize and form unions, collectively bargain and strike. The full discussion is available on Africa World Now Project's YouTube page and Africa Now's SoundCloud page at Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Gurima by Chinoiso Marere. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shaanana Uzain Alamin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East. And that's followed by the Women's Collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by the new show, All Eyes on DC. And that's followed by the new show, New World Order, which is followed by Combit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Kalia Chapman and Brian Burns III. Also, thanks to our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Josh Myers, Kurt Oderson, Chanda Kozer, and Funan Gonda. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. And thank you for joining us. And thanks again for your continued support of Africa Now and all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Flying Bird or Anoma by Osibisa. And this song is 50 years old. It was released in 1976. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Iran is promising a new strategy in its war with the United States. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Following a new wave of U.S. airstrike, Iranian forces launched missiles and drones against U.S. positions and American allies across the Middle East, including Jordan, Bahrain, Kuwait, and Iraq. Iran's security chief says that Iran has a new military, diplomatic, and economic strategy that would shatter the foundations of the United States. Iran says that the attacks are an act of self-defense. Tehran also accuses the U.S. of killing civilians in a strike on a wedding in southern Iran, saying at least four people were killed and dozens wounded. Saudi Arabia says that two sailors were killed aboard a Saudi oil tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps claims separately that two tankers struck mines in the strait. Although Iran claims to be changing its strategy, the recent tit-for-tat exchange is all too familiar to regular listeners.
In other news, for over a decade, the world has been trying to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But a new report from the UN Environment Program today said that is no longer possible. The report finds that the world is on track to cross the 1.5 degrees threshold within a few years, and said bringing temperature rises back to below that threshold would require rapid emission cuts as well as interventions to remove carbon dioxide already in the atmosphere. At the 21st UN Climate Change Conference in 2015, almost all countries in the world signed the Paris Agreement, in which they committed to make efforts to limit global warming. In January of this year, the Trump administration completed its second withdrawal from the Paris Agreement. And in related news, Nepal has launched a push seeking climate compensation from major greenhouse gas emitters following the devastating flash floods last week, putting the cost of recovery at $5 billion, Foreign Minister Shishir Kanal said Nepal contributes only a negligible share of global greenhouse gas emissions, but is facing severe consequences of climate change. Kanal said Nepal's Ministry of Finance has formally sent a climate compensation claim to its international partners. He identified China, the United States, and India as the world's three largest greenhouse gas emitters. In more news, Russian drones are again striking Kiev as Ukraine warns that Russian airspace is becoming too dangerous for commercial aviation. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
Russian drones struck central Kiev today, wounding at least nine people and damaging residential buildings. The strikes came on the seventh consecutive day of heavy attacks from Russia on Ukraine's capital and other key cities. Russia also struck power facilities near Odessa, leaving more than 350,000 homes without electricity. Ukraine is also responding with an expanded drone campaign inside Russia. President Zelensky has warned airlines and insurers that Russian airspace is becoming unsafe because of the growing number of Ukrainian drones. Vladimir Putin has responded with some of his strongest rhetoric yet, accusing Ukraine of state terrorism and saying that Russia will not negotiate with terrorists. He has also threatened further consequences if Ukraine continues to attack his cities. The irony is clear. Russia has spent years launching missile and drones against Ukrainian cities, forcing Ukraine to close its own airspace.